This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin DNR biologist shares the experience of migration for salamanders and other amphibians here in the state, and we'll learn how we can help. Now, a few years ago, after having back surgery, a Wisconsin dairy farmer was looking for something to do. With his computer and some eBay browsing, he discovered the wonders of collecting dairy memorabilia. Ed Larson is a former general manager of Larson Acres Dairy in Evansville. Now he's known for his collection of rare and antique dairy artifacts. We're revisiting a conversation we had with him. Ed, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
In your career working on the family-owned dairy farm, before you got into collecting, were you thinking about the history of dairy farming all along, or was this something you came to later?
Growing up and working with the cows and farming my whole life, until 5 years ago, I never even thought about it.
And what was it that drew you into collecting historical artifacts from the dairy trade?
Well, in 2013, I had back surgery, so I was laid up for a while. And, you know, we've been to antique stores and looking around off and on, and I never really knew what the heck I wanted to collect, if anything. So the first thing I started collecting was milk bottles from Wisconsin. So the first year and a half, that's pretty much all I bought in different cities around Wisconsin was milk bottles. And after that, it kind of, or I couldn't find any more that I didn't have. I had to buy something because it's pretty addicting. So I branched out and bought butter churns and other dairy-related items.
And let's talk about those milk bottles. This was when you had bottlers all over the state, right? And these were these returnable glass bottles.
Yep. I got a bottle that was like one of the first ones made in 1886. And before that, they just scooped it out of one bucket and put the milk in another bucket. Then they came out with these embossed glass. They weren't no color to them in the late 1800s. And they used the embossed bottles until about 1930 to 1935. Then they came out with the colored bottles. They were glass, but they were painted. And they used those for about 20 years. Then grocery stores took over where they didn't no longer need milk delivered to the house anymore.
And these all had their own labels saying where they were from and kind of the brand name. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep. On the front and on the back, they usually have some kind of a slogan. Milk is healthy for you, or, you know, some sort of slogan on the back.
And then you branched out and you've gotten a lot of, you mentioned butter churns, but then you've gotten into different high-tech equipment, high-tech gadgets for, you know, 100, 120 years ago. What kind of things have you found?
Well, just a couple weeks ago, I ran across a fan that stands about 3 foot high. So I got 16-inch brass fans on it, blades, and it turns from the heat of a lantern down at the bottom. It powers the fan. You know, and I'm thinking, I've never seen anything like that before.
Yeah, I never even heard of that.
I haven't either until I've seen it at an auction. Something like that catches my eye. I got some old hand milking machines that I've never seen, I never heard of until, you know, you got into it and start researching. It's just been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I know family members who worked on the farm when electricity first came, and, you know, the electricity went into the barn first before it came into the house. Talk about what dairy farming was like, looking at all this gear, you know, back before electricity changed the game.
Well, basically, all the cows were milked by hand. And most farms only had one or two cows just to feed their family. But then if they got 10 or 12, 20 cows, they still probably milked them by hand until 1910, 1920, where they came out with milking machines that worked fairly decent. But before that time, they had all sorts of inventions, a way to milk cows, but I don't think very many of them worked very well until they come out with a vacuum pulsator.
And now let's talk about how you find this stuff. What is your, well, you don't have to share your secrets, but where do you go to try to find old dairy artifacts?
Look at auctions. You know, I get on the computer. I get alerts for auctions within certain miles. Craigslist, eBay. And now that I've been doing it for 5 years, I got people calling, either want to sell me something or even donate it to my museum.
Right, because people, I'm guessing a lot of people around the state could look in the barn or the basement or the garage or whatever, and they've got something that's been sitting there for maybe, what, 80, 100 years?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and some people, you know, the next younger generation, the grandkids of grandma's house, they find this stuff and they have no idea what it is.
Yeah, do you help people? Do you tell people, you know, hey, here's what this weird thing does that you've had sitting there since before you were born?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's a lot of fun of it. You know, I got people come and look at my stuff, and I got a corner. I got probably 25 things hanging on the rack, and I'll pick it up and try to make them guess what it is. And out of the 25 things, nobody can guess one of them.
And you've got it laid out like in a museum. So if we stop by, what would we see?
You will see just about anything from 150 years old to 100 years old, 75 years old, anywhere from advertising signs to toy wash machines for kids to hot dog bun cutters that were made in 1907 in Milwaukee. They used to cut the bun before they baked it.
Is there something out there that you know exists, Ed, that you've been on the hunt for that you haven't managed to bag yet?
There's one milk bottle from Evansville. I think I got 16 or 17. I've seen one milk bottle from another dairy that I have not received yet or been able to find. Other than that, I don't think there's really one thing I'm looking for. You don't know until you see it. You know, one of them things.
But that's one of the things you're still looking for is right in your backyard there, an old Evansville dairy bottle.
Yep. It's a Charlie Moss milk bottle from Evansville that I've seen it. I've seen two of them, and one Charlie's son owns, and the other one, a neighbor lady from where the dairy was, had one. But I don't know what happened to the rest of them. I guess they got buried or broken or thrown away.
Now, you're looking at all this old-style dairy technology. Do you ever think, oh, it would have been fun and great to be a dairy farmer back then before electricity, or are you glad we do things the way we do them now?
Everything that they made back then, they made it to make their life easier. You know, they used to chop up corn by hand. Well, then in 1872, someone invented a hand crank corn chopper that would be a little bit faster than chopping it by hand, but not a whole lot. And how they bottled the milk, you know, they used to bottle them one at a time. Well, then they bottled six at a time. When I got little cream bottles, then I found a blacksmith made a little pan that could fill five bottles at a time. So it filled the whole row across the crate, probably only one of them. I got several things that are one of a kind.
Before we let you go, Ed, are you running out of room or do you still have some space to fill?
Running out of room.
All right.
I got a lot of it displayed in the office of the farm in the basement. But I got some stuff out in the shed that's under a tarp that I don't have room for. And the plan was same day to open up a visitor center on the farm. I don't know when that is going to be, if ever, but that was my goal when I started, just to preserve the history of some of this stuff. Because another generation, the younger people, are not going to hear grandma talking about getting milk delivered to her house. That whole story is going to be gone.
Well, Ed, thanks a lot, and good luck finding that Evansville milk bottle.
All right, thank you.
That was Ed Larson, former general manager of Larson Acres Dairy in Evansville. We revisited a conversation we had with him about his giant collection of rare and antique dairy memorabilia. Coming up, each spring, salamanders across the state migrate from the logs and forests they live in to the ponds. The journey can be tough for the tiny creatures. We'll learn how this season's decreased car traffic may be helping the amphibians make it safely. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The mayor of Minneapolis is calling for charges against the police officer who kneeled on George Floyd's neck for several minutes while restraining him. Coming up, we'll talk about Floyd's death, the violent demonstrations in the city, and issues of race relations in America. First, with coronavirus stay-at-home and shelter-in-place orders, there have been fewer cars on the road this spring. While the decrease in traffic reduced pollution in some areas, it's also had some additional unexpected benefits like safe salamander migration. Each spring, Wisconsin's tiny amphibians make the journey to the pond. We're learning what it takes now and how humans can help. Rory Pulaski is a conservation biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She works with amphibians and reptiles, including salamanders. Rory, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, Rory, tell us about our Wisconsin migratory amphibians and these salamanders in particular.
Yeah, they're really interesting, and a lot of people don't know their life history. So in Wisconsin, we have almost 20 species of amphibians, and amphibians are made up of frogs and salamanders. And a lot of people are pretty familiar with the frogs, at least, you know in the spring, you kind of hear them, in the ponds when they start breeding into the summer. But people don't know quite as much about the salamanders, and they have the, you know, equally interesting life cycle, if not even more interesting. So several of our salamander species, so the tiger salamander, spotted salamander, and blue spotted salamander, spend their winters in the uplands underground, but they all need to make it to their breeding ponds in the spring to breed. And instead of trickling into the ponds over a few weeks or even a few months, they typically all do it on the same night at a certain site. So it's pretty impressive, yeah.
Have you seen this migration in person?
I have, yeah.
And it's, paint a picture for us. I got to hear this.
Yeah. You know, and sometimes, depending on where you're at, it could be more impressive, you know, in some areas than others, but there's a pond, for example, west of Madison, just a little bit, and the salamanders spend the winters in the uplands on one side of the road, and the first spring rain, kind of warmish rain, every spring, the whole population of adults crosses the road one evening to get to the pond. So, you know, on a slow night, you maybe see 10 to 15 salamanders on the road, but on a busy night, you could see literally up to hundreds of salamanders at one time.
Now, the key word here is road. How big a problem is traffic for this big salamander migration?
Yeah, it's a big problem for them. You know, of course, any of these salamanders we're talking about are not more than 6 inches or so long. And no matter how fast you are, if you're that small, it takes you a little while to get across the road. So any roads around the state or in the country that salamanders have to cross, you know, definitely can be an issue. People, you know, most of these salamanders, actually the three I mentioned, are pretty much black, maybe with colored spots. So they blend in with the road. They're typically crossing at night. Even if you're looking for them, you might not see them. So, there's definitely a huge percentage of salamanders that try to get across the road that don't make it. And that's, you know, they're going to reproduce and make the next class of salamanders. So we lose a lot from a population perspective with roads.
Yeah. Do we put enough of a dent in that population where we're worried about declining numbers because of vehicle traffic?
Yeah, we definitely are. You know, it really is correlated to how busy the particular road is. You know, there's some that they can get safely across, and most of them get across. There's other spots where there maybe are neighborhood groups of individuals, citizens that can safely be out there with, you know, reflective gear and will actually help the salamanders across the road that one night. But if that isn't done or it's a busy enough road, it actually can put a huge dent in the population, if not lead to a significant or even complete decline in the population.
Well, it seems like it'd be hard to prepare for an event like that because you don't know, you know, there's not on the calendar salamander migration night. It's that combination of rain and weather. Is it hard to predict exactly which night it's going to be?
It definitely is. You know, we can kind of look at the weather and, you know, maybe a couple days, 3-4 days ahead of time, we can know when it's coming. But yeah, in terms of really trying to have an organized effort of people to help them cross the road, it's definitely pretty hard to plan for. Yeah.
We're talking to Rory Pulaski, conservation biologist for the state DNR. We're talking about amphibians, especially salamanders, and the way they migrate here in Wisconsin. Now, Rory, we had seen a piece from the New York Times looking at the northeastern U.S. Scientists there trying to figure out if decreased traffic because of, you know, the coronavirus pandemic and the shutdowns related, what kind of impact that would have if salamanders and other amphibians made it across roadways more safely. Is that something you're pondering here in Wisconsin as well?
Yes, we've definitely are curious about it. A lot of times with in any of these amphibian studies, we really need baseline data. You know, we want that scientifically to compare to, and we don't have that at a lot of the sites. But in the coming years, and just, you know, anecdotal reports, it definitely will be interesting to look at next year, or even, you know, later in the summer if people are out looking at the ponds to see what the new age class, the juveniles, if there's rebounding populations. So, yeah, it's definitely something we're interested in looking at, and hopefully we'll be benefiting some of our salamanders in Wisconsin.
I've seen in other contexts the idea that amphibians are kind of a barometer, I guess, of the health of an ecosystem. Is that true here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's definitely true. They, you know, for several different reasons, they're kind of considered like the canary in the coal mine, and that really is true. Part of that is based on their life cycle, and almost all of our amphibians in Wisconsin spend part of their time on land and part of their time in water, so they're exposed to a variety of different habitats throughout their life. And then even just looking at the individuals themselves, the frogs or the salamanders, their skin is very permeable. Most of them, to some degree, can breathe through their skin. So, you know, if they can take in oxygen and absorb water through their skin, that unfortunately also means that if there's any toxins in the environment, they can take those in as well and probably get impacted by them more quickly than other animals would. So they really do, for several different reasons, seem to kind of be an early warning sign for things.
I'll say I've been out and about over the years in Wisconsin a lot. I've seen a lot of frogs. I can't remember seeing much in the way of salamanders. Is it just bad luck or bad timing on my part, or are they more reclusive and we're less likely to see them?
They're definitely more reclusive, yeah. I even, you know, this is what I do for a living, and even when I go out, I'm excited when I see a salamander. They're not quite as easy to find. And the three species I had mentioned earlier, the tiger salamander, spotted salamander, and blue spotted salamander, they're considered mole salamanders. They're in that family, and given that name because they spend most of their time underground. So the tiger salamander, for example, will come up, you know, in the spring, cross the roads if it has to get to a pond, breed, and then go back into the uplands, and it may stay back underground until the fall. Might come up again a little bit, but they spend most of their time underground. If you're lucky and you're kind of in a wet woods, if you're flipping logs, you may find blue spotted, especially. You could find them maybe throughout the summer, but they're pretty reclusive. They're underground, and that's not for a lack of numbers that you're not seeing them. There's been studies in the northeastern part of the country looking at the biomass of salamanders, the number and mass of all the salamanders in an ecosystem, and they've found that salamanders in a lot of sites make up the majority of the biomass. So that's, you know, more biomass of salamanders than mammals and birds and everything else that you would typically imagine. They said, you know, some sites there could be tens, hundreds below you under the ground and you just don't know it. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of them out there. You just don't see them very often.
I know with some frogs, they are heard but not seen so often. Is there a plaintive call of the salamander? Do they make noises that we can hear?
They do not, no. So that's another thing, is that, you know, the frogs kind of lead you to them and you can find out where they are pretty easily. But the salamanders don't make any noise. So, yeah, you don't have that luxury of of getting help locating them.
Now, we've been talking about one threat to salamanders, roadways, the traffic when they're migrating. Are there other areas of concern that threaten salamanders here in the state?
Roads are definitely a big one for them. You know, there's just, you know, in our modern day society, there's a lot of roads, and unfortunately, it separates a lot of their habitat. General habitat alteration, aside from roads, is an issue for them as well. Our species in Wisconsin like different kind of habitats. So the tiger salamander prefers a little bit more open areas, whereas the blue spotted salamander really likes forested areas. So, and small ponds, typically ephemeral ponds in forested areas. So for the blue spotted salamander specifically, you know, if we have a lot of conversion of wooded areas to open areas or subdivisions, the alteration of habitat is definitely a pretty big factor for the salamanders in Wisconsin as well.
Well, getting back to the road hazard then, I know some places around the world for things like turtles have tried to do things to help them get across roads, I think little tunnels and things like that. Apart from, you were mentioning volunteers in reflectors helping control traffic, are there structural ways that we could make known migration paths safer?
There are. It's, you know, a little bit labor intensive, but there have been successful studies around the world. Europe has done quite a few examples of putting in underpasses under the roads. So that's definitely an option, you know, in areas where there's funding and interest in doing that. And, you know, there's an obvious need for that. We can put fences up on one side of the road. You know, it's obviously a pretty big project. It would typically be when a road project was going in, working with DOT if there's some high crossing areas. And for the public, too, what we could really use help with is, you know, any reports, especially of those high migration areas. If we see, you know, we're always interested, like I said, in, you know, even one salamander sometimes. But if we can get reports from people of these high crossing areas, either for salamanders or for frogs, you know, those are similar to what we've done in the past for turtles. We really want to try to get that information and kind of pin down some of those high crossing areas, either to have volunteers be out moving the frogs or to be working with DOT. They've been a great partner with us. I'm working on some of these turtle projects and, you know, hopefully trying to get some underpasses in some of these really critical areas.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Rory, if somebody wants to report salamander sightings or wants to volunteer, what's a way to reach out and do that?
Yeah, they can either contact me directly or we do have a general email address at the DNR. It's DNR Herptiles, H-E-R-P-T-I-L-E-S, at wi.gov. And that's a great place. Otherwise, just Googling DNR salamanders, they'll come to a link where they can email someone as well.
Rory, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Rory Pulaski works for the Wisconsin DNR and was talking with us about salamander migration and how this spring's decreased car traffic may have had an impact to help them get across the road a little more safely this year. Coming up, we'll get reaction to the death of George Floyd while in Minneapolis police custody and the violent protests and demonstrations that have come up around the country that followed. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, get answers to your questions about going back to work and safety concerns during the pandemic. Kate Archer-Kent talks to an expert on employment law. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Minneapolis Fire Department says crews were still putting out fires this afternoon after a night of violent protests in the city. This morning, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey said the violence is not just a reaction to the death of George Floyd, but a long history of injustice towards African Americans.
Over the last 2 days and the emotion-ridden conflict over last night is the result of so much built-up anger and sadness. Anger and sadness that has been ingrained in our Black community, not just because of 5 minutes of horror, but 400 years.
George Floyd was an unarmed Black man who died Monday evening while in police custody. Video shows him in handcuffs, being restrained to the ground while a white officer kneeled on his neck for several minutes. Floyd can be heard yelling repeatedly that he couldn't breathe. Meanwhile, a separate incident in New York City is touching off discussions about how Black people are reported to police, sometimes falsely. Chad Dion Lassiter is executive director of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission, a frequent guest on the show talking about issues of race in America. Chad, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, and good evening.
Well, before we get into broader issues here, can you share your reaction to what's happened over the last few days, Monday in particular, in Minneapolis?
Well, for me, it's both and. It's devastating. It's certainly a part of an American tragedy. Another classic example of how oftentimes some police officers engage in what I would say is implicit as well as explicit biases, as well as, you know, a white supremacist ideology that oftentimes see Black bodies as disposable, rendering them non-void, non-person, non-entity, and engaging in forms of dehumanization. The and part becomes very devastated at the looting. I know oftentimes people have trended with the quote of Martin Luther King that riots are the language of the unheard. But I think if Martin Luther King was here in this moment, he would be saddened by the aspect of the anthology of police brutality by some officers, the maintenance of the blue wall of silence and status quo by several officers, but also of the looting and destroying of property. We don't want property destroyed, nor do we want personhood attacked. But we do have to find a therapeutic way for people to release the anger and pain that the mayor spoke about with regard to generational trauma.
We'll get to some of the concerns about protests and riots in a bit. This case at least seems unusual at the outset. The officers were fired quickly. We'll listen to the Minnesota mayor talking about that more in just a few moments. But also a lot of police chiefs around the country have reacted with alarm and condemnation of the police actions in this case. And things don't always pan out that way, at least not so quickly. What do you make of that response?
I think looking at it from a strengths-based perspective, it puts us into the moment that we're at. 5 years ago, we weren't trending in this moment. And so all of these police chiefs, they need to be commended. And I think we're at a point in time where police departments in various townships, boroughs, and cities all over our democracy are trying to engage in anti-racism training, trying to do programs around diversity and inclusion. And so my hat goes off to them. It's devastating that something like this continues to occur. But looking at it, if we're going to look at an aspect of hope, I'm hopeful that, you know, more police departments and more police chiefs around our democracy will trend in the same very direction.
I want to give a listen again to the mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey, talking about what he hopes happens next when it comes to the police officers involved.
Why is the man who killed George Floyd not in jail? If you had done it, or I had done it, we would be behind bars right now. And I cannot come up with a good answer to that question. And so I'm calling on Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman to act on the evidence before him. I'm calling on him to charge the arresting officer in this case.
Do you agree that the officer should be charged, Chad?
Certainly, the officer should have been charged and the officer should be behind bars. The mayor was not asking a Socratic question. I have an answer to what the mayor posed. The reason why he's not been arrested at the present time is simply because what we're really looking at is this whole aspect of protecting whiteness. Whiteness protects the mob, but it doesn't protect those who get mobbed. And so I understand what the mayor is talking about. And I think that's the challenge that we have on all sides of the color line, but specifically for African-Americans who tend to say, why is it that we're dying and you find a convenient and sophisticated way to apprehend others like Dylann Roof and multiple others? And so definitely he needs to be charged, and it needs to be swift justice with regards to him being charged.
Talking to Chad Dion Lassiter. He's with the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. We often call him up to talk about issues related to race here in the United States. And Chad, I mean, we've had something like this discussion, you and I, a number of times over the years. Do you think, what is it going to take to move the needle to where we don't need to have this conversation again?
You're absolutely right, Rob. I think you and I have been trending coming up on almost a decade. And I think what's going to have to happen is that we're going to have to really look at policy. There has to be, and I don't think there's an antidote for this. I think we have to look at what the mayor actually stated. We have to have a conversation about white racism and white violence that starts from the inception of our democracy throughout the Civil War and brings us into the contemporary era. For your listening audience, that's not an indictment against white individuals when we talk about white privilege, white supremacy, white arrogance, and things of that nature, because we have whites who are just as distraught and disappointed of this killing. To hear the word that we heard with Eric Garner, I can't breathe again. So I think it's training. I think it's policy. I think it's ongoing dialogue around the underpinnings and the framework of implicit, explicit biases. And I think also not to rush to judgment. We want the community to see the humanity of our officers who stop us for whatever reason, but we want officers to also see the humanity of black and brown people that they stop as well. So I think policies, centered around teaching people that they can file a formal complaint, also informing people of our ethnic and hate intimidation laws. And if you're not going to get recourse, even though this individual is dead, unfortunately, you can also file for civil remedies as well. And that's what happened in the Eric Garner's case as well. So I think it's just a plethora of just coalition building policies, getting the Department of Justice involved, and multiple others.
Now, in this particular case, initially, reportedly, the police department said that that Floyd had died of a medical incident during the arrest while he was in police custody. If a bystander hadn't been taking a video of this, do you suspect we wouldn't know about it? Don't know what had happened here?
I don't want to rush the judgment, but one of the things that we do know is that given the context of the COVID-19, as well as the pandemic of hate and the virus of hate that permeates aspects, or if not all of our democracy, you have a lot of people of color who have pre-existing conditions for multiple reasons. So we saw that excuse come out with Eric Garner in New York that he was rather obese. He still shouldn't have been choked. He said he couldn't breathe. You should have saw his humanity. In this situation, the gentleman is saying that he couldn't breathe. It didn't matter if he had type 1, type 2 diabetes, hypertension. It didn't matter if he was asthmatic. When he said he could not breathe, as a human, and because the cop is a human as well, the cop should have seen his humanity and trended in the direction to take his knee off of his neck. When we look at the graphic images, not just the 5-minute video, but the graphic images, the cop has his hand in his pants and he's looking as if this is just a casual thing that you do, that you put a knee on a person until they suffocate. And so I really fundamentally believe that what cameras provide us is an opportunity to capture forms of systemic and structural oppression that oftentimes without the camera, it would be speculating. But even with the camera, individuals who are dead are still being tried from the grave. We have to articulate the narrative that he was a Harvard graduate. It doesn't matter if he had a degree from Harvard University or a GED. He's, in fact, a human being.
And Chad, getting back to you also, you mentioned the both and the issue of the protests, some looting, things turning violent in some cases. I don't know. How is that? How can that anger be channeled in a way that can make positive change?
To be honest with you and to continue to be who I am, which is walk in truth, kindness, and love, I really don't know. What I can share is that when I was in Ferguson, right around the time of the looting and after the looting, I worked with several community organizations and specifically children around play therapy, art therapy, music therapy. I just fundamentally believe that we just have to get together and have a conversation, specifically social workers, psychologists, sociologists, about what can we do when people reach this level. There are really fundamentally just two ways that you cope, adaptively and maladaptively. But I understand the anger, but I cannot sit still as a human being and condone, you know, the throwing of bottles at authority, even though I understand the anger, the destruction of property, nor do I want to see anyone attack people from a personhood standpoint. But I'm open to learn. I'm in the learning process of this as well as it pertains to where does the outpouring of grief. And when the mayor talks about 400 years of generational trauma, people may say, well, how does that work in the contemporary? Well, it's the negating of a person's humanity that continues to occur. It happened on the slave blocks, it happened in the cotton fields, and now it's happening on the streets of America. Tamir Rice, Sandra Bland, Eric Garner, and so forth and so on.
We're talking about the death of George Floyd while in Minneapolis police custody, the protests, the violence in the city that followed. Chad Dion Lassiter is executive director of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission, frequent guest here on Central Time talking about issues of race in America. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your reaction to Floyd's death, the shocking video? What should happen to the officers involved in this case? How does this fit into wider issues of race in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about race relations in America with Chad Dion Lassiter, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission, looking at the death of George Floyd after a white Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck for minutes while restraining him. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your takeaway from that incident, the protests and violence that followed, other similar cases around the United States? How can we prevent these kind of things from happening again? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Mike is on the line in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hello. So I think this goes beyond just basic racism, because as a white male, I have personally been beat up by white officers, black officers, and one Asian officer. And each time I was attacked by police was because I was standing up for an unarmed citizen being abused by the police. And I've stood up for people, for women, for people of color, and it didn't matter. And the police will always stand up for themselves. So beyond the racist part, I think this is a blue racism. This is just a police state, and they're going to stick up for each other no matter what. And
Mike, thanks for the call. Chad, Mike, talking about what people call sometimes a blue wall of silence.
Mike is absolutely right when he talks about the blue wall of silence. That's a form of the maintenance of the status quo, but it's not beyond racism. It's, in fact, white supremacy, because Dylan Roof kills 9 people in a black church, and they apprehended him and ended up taking them to Burger King on the way to the police station. So I advocate for what Mike said, and I don't want to take agency away from him, but Mike is still living. And so what is it about black bodies? What is it about a black man who's in Central Park engaged in a phenomenon or hobby of watching birds sing and chirp and engage with one another, that he just simply says, hey, can you put your dog on a leash? And then it's the historical narrative that we see trending where some white individuals feel comfortable to call the police and say that they're in the victimization role and that someone's attacking them. So I hear what Mike is saying, but when we look at Timothy McVeigh, Jeffrey Dahmer, the Branch Davidians, when we look at Ted Bundy and multiple whites who have engaged in horrific acts, they tend to be taken alive. Tamir Rice had a water gun. He lost his life. Sandra Bland was making a turn signal. She lost her life. You know, and so that's where the challenge becomes in our democracy. It's implicit, explicit bias and his white supremacy, not by all cops, but he's absolutely right with the wall, blue wall of silence, which is a form of racism as well.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Mary joins us now in Milwaukee. Mary, hi.
Yes.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Mary?
Oh, I was just wanted to say the guest had said that he was willing to learn. And again, I was trying to find out, what are you trying to learn from this incident? Because many incidents have taken place similar to this and the same outcome. So I just need to know what you're trying to learn, because we should have learned long ago about this type of violence against the people of color.
Mary, thanks for the call. Chad, what would you say to Mary?
I would say that if Mary heard me correctly, the context that you posed to me, Rob, was like, what can we do to reduce some of the looting and things of that nature? And I said, I don't know. It would be disingenuous placating, ingratiating, and displaying with false generosity if I was to say I had all the answers. I'm not trying to learn about the anthology of police brutality. I'm trying to still be in the learning mode. I think this is a teachable moment for all of us. And a teachable moment for me is when people are angry psychologically, and they want to destroy property or maybe destroy people, what therapeutic environment can we create for them to have a therapeutic outlet? Because when you're looting and when you're destroying property and when you're throwing things at authorities, they also may feel anger, and the whole entire milieu is heightened that what happens if a police officer decides to shoot back because they're protecting themselves. So I hope that I provided further clarity for that. I think everything that this situation teaches us is a teachable moment. Don't rush to judgment. That videotapes are great to have. That we have a mayor who does not look like the population that died, and he's trending on the side of truth, love, and kindness because he sees the humanity of George Floyd.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Chad Dion Lassiter about the death in police custody of George Floyd in Minneapolis earlier this week and the protests, the reactions since then. Back to your calls now. Julia is with us in Madison. Julia, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I just want to say, as a white American, I'm heartbroken, distraught, at one, yes, what these police officers have done, I believe that they need to be brought to justice, and I do believe that they need to see prison time. I think it is a bigger issue. I don't think it's just the police. Let's look at the gentleman that was gunned down while running down, was it Missouri? I think this is a huge problem for our country, and my heart goes out to all African Americans and to our country. I think in many ways we haven't grown as much as we think we have in racism and how we look at our fellow man. And I appreciate what the gentleman is sharing today in regards to learning from this and what can we do in going forward. I also understand about why the people in Minneapolis are so angry. Do I believe violence is the answer? No. But I think in many situations, people have tried to be calm and learn from situations, but then you have a repeat of situation like this, and people are up in arms of what do we do?
Julia, thanks a lot for the call. Julia referring, I think, Chad, to Ahmaud Arbery, who was shot in Georgia back in, I believe, February. Your thoughts, and I've seen some people like our caller who are white, who are wondering, you know, how they can make a difference apart from feeling bad about what's happened.
Well, I think if you go by what she just stated so eloquently, you heard her passion. I think what happens is we're seduced into the concept of race that we oftentimes trend on the level of ethnocentrism. And we think that, okay, there are not whites out here who are concerned about black humanity, or there are conservative people out here who don't see transphobia, homophobia, and xenophobia. So she's absolutely right. And for African Americans and minorities, we need to not say, oh, that's just a white person who is racist and who's liberal, hiding their true racism behind their liberalism, or that's a white person who engages in benevolent racism. There are, as she stated herself, white individuals who are distraught, who are despondent, who are depressed because of this situation and multiple situations. And so I think we continue to do coalition building on every side of the color line, every side of the gender line. And she's right, because it's macro, it's institutional racism, prejudice plus power. When you have educational apartheid, economic injustice, environmental racism, and then also within certain demographic groups, if people are engaging in forms of despair, hopelessness, COVID-19 has everyone in a state of shock. It's a global pandemic. And then the challenge that we have is, even with this pandemic, it has not stopped forms of violence towards black people: jogging while black, reading the Bible while black, sleeping in the library at Yale University while black. And it just becomes a continued problem. And so we have to really put laws forward that say that if you call the police on a black person, because it's trending towards black people, and it doesn't pan out to be anything, then there has to be some sort of, you know, punishment for that. Not, you know, putting people behind bars for a year or anything like that, but it should be some sort of fine from a policy perspective.
In our last few moments, Chad, what do you want people to be thinking about learning in the days to come?
That we're all part of the human race, and this is not a touchy-feely, kumbaya, we shall overcome moment that I'm sharing, but we're part of the human race. We have to have a frank conversation of the racial elephant in the room, which is a diseased democracy, not just a fractured and faltering democracy, but a diseased democracy that has to have a frank conversation about why it surveillances black bodies, the surveillance of black bodies, the suspicion of black males and brown and black people has got to be a part of a conversation. And I think that this was another opportunity with your callers and several callers in your listening audience for white people to recognize white privilege exists. Don't give up your privilege, but how can you leverage your privilege on behalf of black humanity, white poor humanity, and all humanity?
Chad, thanks again for joining us today.
Always good to be on your show. Take care. Thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Chad Dion Lassiter, Executive Director of the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. We talked to him about the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis police custody. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Twitter provided fact checks for a couple of statements by the president. A Wisconsin expert joins the show for a look at how fact checking is done and whether it makes a difference. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. Asparagus is coming into season here in Wisconsin. We can get the good local stuff. We'll find out lots of ways to use it, cooked and even raw. Join in with your favorite way to cook asparagus. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, it's a weekly call-in for kids and parents with a focus this time around on rats, snakes, and turtles. Join the conversation tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And many people are unemployed right now. What about all those recent graduates or upcoming graduates ready to enter the job market? What is their job outlook? Our guest looks at the landscape for new grads and has some advice, too. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.